You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Bill Kelly Jr. He's talking to me from L.A. Bill, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So, Bill, I want to talk about some of your projects, but just to begin, so the audience understands where you're coming from, what is the totality of things you're working on in different areas as an educator and curator and writer? What are the projects you're currently involved in?
To begin with, on the teaching level, I just left Otis College of Art and Design as a professor in the Graduate Public Practice Program. It was a graduate program for community-based art practices that was started by Suzanne Lacy about 9-10 years ago. And I'm currently at Cal State Bakersfield at professor of Latin American and Latino studies with an emphasis on community engagement. And so being here at the sort of at the base level in the Central Valley in California is an important move. To me, the Central Valley has two important antecedents for social practice, as we might call it. One of them is, of course, the feminist art program that started up in Fresno, and the other one is community-based organizing through the work of Cesar Chavez and other community organizers here in the southern Central Valley near Bakersfield. So there's something very interesting about these kinds of two foundational sources for social practice in Southern California. And the Central Valley never comes up as a conversation when you're talking about it in the LA art world. So I'm here teaching. I'm working on a book that's going to be published hopefully mid this year called Collective Situations, Dialogues in Contemporary Latin American Art, 1985-2010. It's an anthology that I've been working on with Grant Kester. It's 21 case studies of community-based social dialogical art practices across the Americas. And that's through Duke University Press. And then finally, as a curator, I'm working on one of the exhibitions for the Getty's initiative called Pacific Standard Time, LALA, stands for Los Angeles and Latin America, or Latin America and Los Angeles. And that show will be hosted at Otis College of Art, which they all inaugurate mid-September of 2017. And my exhibition is called Talking to Action. And it's about, in some ways, connecting the book research to an exhibition formats, community-based practices across the Americas, and looking at several case studies and experimenting with what curatorial work looks like when you're working with these kinds of practices. That's kind of a little bit of what's on my plate these days.
Okay, that sounds like a full plate. So before we get into some of those specific projects, you know, as you talk about your teaching in Otis and now here, one thing that strikes me or that I'm kind of compelled to ask is in social practice, which, of course, you know, I'm familiar with as well, interview a lot of artists in social practice, and really that's my field or that's how I see it as an artist doing a program like this. Do you feel that in the current political climate, there's any kind of an emphasis on that? Does that change or impact what social practice means in reaching out to communities? And it doesn't have to. I'm not really steering this into politics, but, you know, this year seems that it's going to be dominated by this kind of very unusual situation we're in with Trump, and the arts seem to play a very unusual role and seems to even be having a kind of unusual amount of solidarity with, you know, performers not at the inauguration and visual artists and all over the country and world, I'm sure, are tackling these issues. And so what I'm asking is, do you think that there will be a shift in how communities are engaged in terms of social practice because of the political climate?
God, I hope so. You know, I mean, these are practices that have been around for a very long time, as you probably well know. So, and certainly there's so much emerging support for them. within institutions and foundations, and now, you know, people like me thinking about how do you curate in that, in those kinds of scenarios. So certainly the groundwork in terms of the infrastructure of the art world seems to be increasingly paying more attention to how to support it. And so now if this happens to take up a certain space of it in the social realm, I mean, we'll have to wait and see if that in fact happens. You know, I think that there's still a lot of work left to be done, obviously. I mean, we don't even have a lexicon for this kind of practice quite yet. We certainly don't know how to teach it quite yet. I mean, Otis has been attempting to do it. Now, increasingly, there are other programs who are trying to teach this. You know, in this country, I should say. And then, you know, there are theorists who are, you know, writing about it. But there's still so much work. And the, you know, these practices never really had a seat at the table. You know, and I should say, you know, in Latin America, these kinds of practices don't even have a seat at the art table either. They operate within the social sciences. You know, they've historically operated within, you know, and within the realm of politics or you know, community education, popular education practices, or in academia within the social sciences of official anthropology and sociology and other disciplines. And so the art world has never really paid attention to it, to support, to theorize it, to curate it, to exhibit it, to understand it. And yet all of these people are all the people I've been talking to you about, they're all artists. They're all working with art. And yet the art world has watched it with a little bit of vigilance. So I don't know. We'll have to see if these bridges cross and these things can take up. I certainly hope so, but I'd probably want to hear from an artist. Maybe you tell me if you see that happening. It might be, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's not that I have seen that happening. It's something that I think is, if I can say this, is sort of a, you know, perhaps a silver lining of this kind of awful situation that we're in that if we're under a very oppressive regime, or historically artists under oppressive regimes have sought freedom from that regime, either through, you know, actions or art somehow. And since we're entering into that phase, I do interview more artists and hear artists, you know, saying like, how do you make art in this kind of a scenario? It's like if we're at war, you know, in the middle of a world war, how do you make art and what is it about? And and artists are answering questions for those artists and saying, you know, it's more important to make art now than ever. And it doesn't have to be about politics or activism, but it's you know, some kind of as I'm gathering, Lori Scheck put it very beautifully. She's a writer that I interviewed recently and said, you know, art is about being free, about allowing yourself to be curious about anything you want to be curious about. And and that's a position that not everybody's into to enjoy. So I don't have an answer for it easily, but since I'm kind of answering your almost question to me about that, I think there's a possibility that there could be more solidarity and more action towards that, which you know, to me, I see even Hollywood and all the performers at the inauguration pointing towards a bit in that in this kind of solidarity against not doing something, you know, this idea of the absence of work, this idea of, you know, Richard Prince, you know, revoking ownership of an Ivanka Trump picture of his is kind of very unusual steps that I think could indicate something more. So I want to talk more about also your projects, but when you talk about these kind of practices that were relegated to the social sciences and are not easily incorporated into the art world, can you talk about a little bit, just so the listeners are clear, what kind of practices do you mean that are that are perhaps marginalized or not understood. And if you want, you can take this right into Pacific Standard Time show or the difficulty of curating those. But perhaps you can talk about, if you could talk about some examples of those and how you define this kind of medium that's hard to teach and curate.
Sure. Now, when I made the comment about that, I was making specifically about Latin America, but, you know, it possibly could extend to some degree and in some facets to the United States as well.
Well, yeah, because in the United States, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but in Otis or other places, it's difficult to really teach social practice, isn't it? I mean, it's hard to teach visual art in one way, but social practice is even more, it seems to me, hard to grasp, and it has so many varieties that I would think it's even hard to critique.
Right. And I think that one of the things that Suzanne did when she started the program was that, you know, you have to put the you know, incoming students' commitment to working in public and to the publicness of their practice above anything else, above everything else. Because that commitment has to be there. You can't teach that commitment. And, you know, the particularities of how that commitment defines itself or frames itself as a form of, you know, artistic aesthetic reimagining, you can work on that. Right, that can be nurtured, that can be mentored, that can be critiqued, and so it's pretty experimental in that sense. You know, you have students who come in from all sorts of backgrounds that where art is perhaps the secondary part of where they are coming from. You know, public education or public health or community organizing or whatever, and yet. They're interested, you know, they use art to some degree in that practice, and they're coming to finding a way to I guess, professionalize that as an art practice to some degree. Mm-hmm. So that commitment is like, it's, I think, is one thing you it's difficult to teach, so to speak. But, you know, these practices in the cases of, like, Latin American practices, you know, like I said, you know, they're really, you make the argument, they're born out of a long chain of events starting with, you know, the larger decolonization movements that began in the 50s and you know, the Tricontinental in Cuba or the Bandung Conference in Indonesia, and these things manifest themselves in social and political movements throughout Latin America that then become, you know, the groundwork for, you know, liberation types of pedagogy, the work of Paulo Freire ends up being a movement within the Catholic Church of liberation theology. It ends up being a movement within the social sciences. It starts, you know, collecting and really concentrating on thinking about how to understand the complexities and the inequalities in Latin America through social science research, which then become universities. All of these things lead to kinds of collective work and methodologies of teaching and learning, which then leave a legacy for today for artists. You know, and interestingly enough, I remember when I was asking, talking with Suzanne about, you know, about her work and at the, you know, at the Feminist Art Program and when it moved to CalArts in the mid-70s, you know, what were you guys teaching? What were you guys reading? You know, we teach so much theory in these programs today. What were you guys reading? What kind of theory were you guys covering? And she replied to me with a shrug, like, you know, we weren't really reading any theory. We were reading Paulo Freire and Saul Alinsky, and that was it. And, you know, it just kind of dawned on me that, of course, there is this very close link now. There is a link that connects the Chicano activism to feminist social movements and other things that connect back to Freire, that have a sort of direct link with these kinds of social movements that are also happening in the United States, but are also happening in Latin America through Freire's work. So, you know, these things don't come from arts, but they come from other disciplines. And, you know, this is quite normal for me as an arts historian, you know, art history doesn't generate its own art history, doesn't generate its own theory most of the time. You know, it has to borrow it from all these other fields and disciplines and places, and then brings it to support, you know, critique or some sort of theorization of visual arts. But I think that there's a very interesting thing to think about: where are the roots of social practice theory, and where do they really come from? Because we can't just assign it. We can't assign everything to, you know, the Frankfurt School. I mean, you just can't. You got to think of other places and fountains of where these things can emerge from. And I think in the case of social practice, and I would say in Southern California and the Southwest in general, you could probably make a good argument for ideas emerging from Latin America. And so that's an argument you don't hear very much. And so the book kind of starts to begin to make these make certain claims, because it's where these case studies in the collective situations book is about, you know, laying out where all of these practices, you know, are from the artist's voice, what they're doing and what they're trying to say, and so it gives an interesting panorama of the movement right now of the last 20 years of social practice in Latin America. And I think that you know, a follow-up to that book might be to go back historically and trace some of these ideas back to these liberatory practices and theories of social practice through the work of Freire and the larger decolonizing movement in Latin America. And that's the book I'm working on now. But it's hard to, you know, it is Latin America, but in some ways I feel like it could provide an interesting precedent for a conversation that connects certain practices in the United States to some of the teachings and ideas that were emerging there. That's a longer term conversation, but I think it's good that in the United States you get yourself off the North Atlantic channel of information is the only place where you can look, right? That's right. Theoretically, historically, that's what we've always done, and I think it's been to the detriment of a wider ecology of knowledge of how we could talk about these practices and really understand, you know, art in a much more fuller way. So that's part of a larger interest I have.
And so to talk about Pacific Standard Time or that LALE initiative, LA in Latin America, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about curating that and maybe give some examples of who would be in that exhibit and how you're curating it and what the work looks like or how the work is presented?
Sure. From the get-go, this the LALA title is a weird one, right? It's a dichotomy that implies a relationship, right? It's LALA. So for my own part, you know, as a Latino who was born and grew up in LA and has been studying Latin American Latino art to some degree, whether it's colonial studies in the earlier part of my life or in contemporary studies now, you know, I'm fully well aware of how, you know, Latin American art or even Latino, you know, communities of migrant Latino artists in Southern California have not really ever been fully represented within the cultural institutions of Los Angeles. That's something that needed to be addressed. I'm glad that Getty, whether that was their intent or not, somehow addressing this issue. When that LALA kind of name comes up, you start thinking, well, what that relationship is. And for myself, I even though my parents are migrants, I don't want to be the U.S. bred scholar who goes and picks works out in Latin America and brings it back to U.S. audience, especially with these kinds of practices. It would be really a bad idea. So the first thing I did was to say, well, I need to work with researchers in these various cities in the Americas, and we need to have a dialogue. And that's what we need to do for the first 2 years. And that's what we did. We worked with six other researchers. Most of them do not come from art history. They come from various other disciplines, sociology, anthropology, and such. But they're all people of kind of emerging voices in the field, thinking about where these practices operate as within the language of art, and that's the key thing. These practices have been happening for a very long time, but maybe have not been theorized within art, right? Because the visual anthropologist has a different concern, right? They're looking at it from a different lens than, let's say, someone from art or art theory. So it was important to collect these researchers to work together to think about these conversations. And immediately, all of these contradictions of how I was taught in the United States and how they were taught in their respective countries and cities came to the foreground. That was the first thing that we saw, right? That I was talking about art and artists, and they were talking about cultural practitioners. So that problem of, like, me, an art historian trained in art history, bringing artists into an art school funded by a major art funder and an art institution like the Getty, all these layers of art find the face of how these practices operate and are understood and are investigated in their own home countries, right? There's a very interesting that was a very important point to bring out, right? To think about how these various ways in which we understand these practices and very close proximity to ourselves, right? I mean, you could say Colombia is not that far away, and yet the way they study and understand these practices, the funding sources, the people who study them, the researchers, and how they prepare for the research, that's there's such a wide distance between what they do and what I have been taught to do. So it's important to understand those distinctions and then to bring those to the foreground and make sure that was part of the story. So we bring the researchers together, we have these various conversations, we start to understand how the various ways in which these things are understood and taught. And we decided that what was important was that, of course, you have to bring in certain case studies of things that have been most recently done. The show is about contemporary work. But the Getty also has this problem where it doesn't want to commission new work because it's not in the business of creating new acquisitions for these types of things. It's supposed to do historic work. And of course, how do you show historic social practice? Like, already a kind of a problem.
Right.
Yeah, and so
what do you do? How is that exhibited? And how do you show that?
Right. So what I decided to do was I'm making it public for the first time, and I just said screw it. I went ahead and what I did was I said, listen, let's think about your continual research. These practices don't ever end, really. Sometimes these things go on for 10, 15, 20 years. So let's think about a project that you've been doing for a long time, and let's think about how we can help you continue the project. Right? Let's think about how to help you. So we're not really commissioning new work; we're just continuing on with the research that's been doing. Right? All of these projects are so embedded to pedagogical labor. Let's just continue the teaching. Let's just continue the learning. So a project like, let's say, a collective from Brazil called Frente Tese Severo. We've been researching the history of the development of a certain police tactic that operates in the black favelas of Brazil. They're called UPPs, Unidade de Policias Pacificadoras. These UPPs, you might have heard about them during the Olympics and stuff, the protests in these favelas. These special types of police-keeping forces were actually born in Colombia during the 80s and 90s. Trained by U.S. military personnel and right-wing paramilitary groups to fight leftist guerrillas. These policing tactics then became professionalized in the favelas in Rio de Janeiro. And then after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti and Port-au-Prince, they were brought in by NATO to control the black population in Haiti. So it's very interesting. So they started doing the research connecting these three black cities, Medellin, Rio de Janeiro and Port-au-Prince, and how the police, the tactics of policing, have this interconnectedness to global economics. So they've been doing this research now for like 6-7 years. In fact, I created a project in Medellin in 2011. I brought them to do research there. So now 2017 hits, and they're continuing on with their work. And so we said, well, listen, let's continue this research. We funded their trip to Haiti to finish the documentary and continue on with their work cartographing and mapping out these relationships. So in fact, we found a way to like say, you know what, we're gonna continue on with this labor because it's important labor to do. And that's how we sort of went around the idea of not commissioning new work and yet somehow working with historical kind of projects that had been working for long term. So you know, that's one of the ways in which curatorially I thought we could justify that kind of support, and also added a model in some ways for how I'm supposed to operate as a curator, right? So
that makes sense of kind of, you know, continuing the research, because as you're saying, and in the example you gave, these are research-based projects of artists and or collectives, you know, continuing to investigate and document actions of police in the case you were talking about in Black communities.
And documentaries get made, and films get made, and performances are performed, and you know, all these kinds of things are done. And in the spirit of teaching and learning, that, you know, the Frente is, I think, fairly well known at this point, but these are not people who are like, you know, jumping on planes to exhibit at the next biennial, right? They're still operating in a certain way and researching in a certain way and for a certain reason. So it's important to, you know, to give them also a platform. And so the platform in this case, you know, it was important that it was housed and anchored in an art in a learning institution, which is Otis College of Art. So that learning institution then, you know, then brings some students and other faculty, and then brings in the resources of the university to you know, to help support the project, right? It made less sense to bring it, let's say, to a museum that had never had a history of working with these practices, right? We have the MFA program, and then we have a university that's worked with these kinds of practices before. The last PST was the Women's Art Building Show. They had a notice. So there's a history and there's a memory, like an institutional memory of how these things happen. So that's why it kind of makes sense to keep that cohesive kind of investigation around teaching and learning as a thread that connects everything together.
That makes sense. And so in this upcoming, when will that come together? What's happening with Pacific Tide?
So PST will be inaugurating mid-September, like September 15th, roughly, in LA. And some institutions in San Diego and Santa Barbara as well. So they'll all inaugurate. And, you know, for us, those things, the inauguration is just one point along many different practices to get done. So artists are coming in this whole semester long. To do residencies, research, work with students, this kind of thing. Some will be here for the opening, and some will come afterwards to continue on with that work. Some practices are existing and operating with very little support from our end, and they're doing their works. Some of the work that's being done by Ultra Red, Unión de Vecinos, and School of Echoes around gentrification, Boyle Heights. Right, that got a lot of press recently. That whole project, you know, is an initiative that started by that whole group of people working together. And
that initiative, just to be clear to people who don't know about it, can you tell me a little bit about what that initiative is or
right.
How
that relates to you? There's a conversation that's starting in that has been starting, obviously, but it's been starting recently in the press about protests. Some artists and community groups are making of galleries in Boyle Heights, and what they're protesting is the gentrification and the continual displacement of communities of color in Boyle Heights and in the eastern part of Los Angeles. Historically, Latino neighborhood. And it got a lot of press because, the protests were protesting art galleries, and the art world is like, who protests art galleries? And I think it's an important conversation to have, regardless of who gets their feelings hurt and all this, because, the art world does have a role to play, as we all know, in development and real estate speculation. At this moment when the art world is supposed to be thinking about its relationship to Latin America, well, why not think about the displacement of Latin American immigrant and Latino communities in their own city? So that was one project that we tried to support and are going to be exhibiting in the show. But it's an effort that goes way beyond our show. It's its own effort. That was you could Google those keywords of gentrification, Boyle Heights, art galleries, those kinds of things, and there's a lot of press on it already. It ended up in Art Forum, and it ended up in New York Times, ended up in Hyperallergic, all sorts of places. But I think that what's important is that there's a group of artists and there's a group of activists that are willing to ask the questions about where are our priorities when it comes to issues around development and displacement and gentrification in a city that's getting increasingly every day more and more expensive to live in. It's not the LA I grew up in. It's an LA that's becoming harder and harder to live in because of the rising housing costs. As artists, as activists, as art historians, as critics, as curators, the whole world gamut of people who are really, really well educated and have gotten into the field for really beautiful and often very kind of selfless reasons, right? For the love of art and beauty and thinking about the wider good, it's imperative that we also hold our feet to the fire about our own role in this and what we should be doing to be more conscious and to be more effective about not being part of a system that doesn't operate for the good of the larger community. So these are that project myself I'm particularly keen on because it's asking a set of questions that locally that I don't think a lot of people in the arts are asking themselves, and I'm proud that it's in some small way we're helping it along.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of ambitious and of course important to continue to do, especially as we started out talking about in these times where the momentum, as you're talking about, of gentrification and wealth inequality seems to continue to increase. So I think doing what you're doing and especially curating this way continues to be not only needed but ambitious, because it's difficult to do, right? To actually mount a show like this that is something that everybody can understand and that also continues the agenda of the artists that were initially involved or that you're showing, it seems.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do. No, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. it's a very demanding thing to do. And I should say that for the case of the project I just mentioned with Ultraved, Unión de Vecinos, who's a housing rights organization, School of Echoes, which is an artist group, kind of pedagogy, theater of conversation. They're not the ones, that group is not the ones leading the, really framing what the conversation is. It's the community that they work with. I've been to a few of these meetings. And when they go to Pico Gardens housing development, it's right on the river in Los Angeles, the one that they're most concerned about being being displaced because of the you know, the intense interest that the Los Angeles and developers have in you know, kind of reframing the river, the LA River, as a sort of site for new growth. You know, it's, you know, you go to these meetings and it's the mothers, it's the women in those communities who come to those meetings and are framing what the conversation should be. And that's an amazing thing to watch. You know, and, you know, that I just wanted to point that out, because so much of the conversations in the press have been how these artists, interlopers have come in and created these, you know, agitating these issues. And it's the people, it's the women in the community in particular who are the ones who are framing the language about how this thing should happen. So I want to point that out.
I'm glad you did. And before I ask you the last question, the book that you're working on, that will also frame some of these issues as well. Is that correct? The collective situations, readings in contemporary Latin American art, or will that really be a different tactic in that particular book?
Well, that book is really kind of an introduction into some case studies, right? There are two that are kind of more historic from the 90s, late 90s. One is it's a text by Gustavo Bontix about the washing of the flag, this kind of collective civic protest against the Fujimori regime and dictatorship in Peru in the late 90s, and the other one is Pilar Riaño Susan Lacy's project of Skin of Memory in Medellin in the late 90s. But for the most part, they're all kind of very contemporary projects, and it's just a way of sort of you know, introducing an English-speaking audience to projects they might not have, you know, or projects that they might have heard about but don't really know. Some projects, I guarantee, they don't know. these are people who are working in pure obscurity from the art world's, you know, kind of purview. And others, like, you know, the Etc. Collective, have gained some concrete kind of interest by the art world. It's been writing on their work already. But for the most part, the idea is to, like, introduce this, you know, because it is a question of the lexicon, right? How do you speak about these things? Where do they come from? Where do the ideas emerge from? So we just displace it a little bit from just thinking about them in this country, the United States, as, you know, something emerged only from Black Mountain College or only emerged from the situations. I mean, that's very limited in the scope of what's possible, especially when you have an entire hemisphere right here that has been doing this amazing work for decades. So it was really about I don't want to use the term very, very kind of just loosely, but in some ways there has to be an attempt to kind of decolonize a little bit the discourse and the habitual kind of like knee-jerk reaction to always look through the North Atlantic Channel about where history comes from. You know, so there's something that it's an attempt to sort of just introduce these projects to a wider audience to say, look, here are some things you probably didn't know about.
Right. Well, I'm glad that's coming out. And the last question I wanted to ask you is one that I ask everybody is what are you reading now? Which doesn't have to be related, or it could be related to our discussion, but just curious what book or books you're reading at the moment.
Yeah, you know, I'm working on a book that's a takeoff of a dissertation I wrote on the history of the legacy of liberation theology, which is like I said, it was a social movement. It was also a theological movement within the Catholic Church within Latin America in the 1960s. 70s, and and how it left a particular kind of legacy for social practice artists. And so I've been reading a lot about the history of this kind of decolonial labor, and also diving in a lot into like theological thinking. I have a master's degree in colonial art studies, so I have a long and I worked in that field for a while, and I have a long background into thinking about the history and legacy of the Catholic Church in Latin America. So this is just an extension of that. So I've been reading a lot about those kinds of things. The history of the church and the history of some of the most important writers around the church, Gustavo Gutierrez, a famous theologian who wrote about, who coined the term liberation theology. People like Silvia Rivera Cusiganqui, who's an Aymara sociologist in Bolivia, who really thinks about the kind of, how does indigenous thinking look into the future? Right now I'm reading specifically a text by this, I think he's a sociologist, Boaventura de Souza Santos, works in Portugal, also in Brazil, and he writes about specifically the kind of like how colonial thinking in fact affected Europe in so many ways, which is a really important point to think about, right? It doesn't just affect Latin America, it affected Europe in certain ways. And so he goes in and examines, like, what was left out, right? By excluding all of this knowledge, you impoverished your own ecology of knowledge, as he would say. So so those are the kinds of things that I've been reading about, so thinking about this next...
Fascinating, yeah, those could be so many conversations in themselves. Really interesting text. So, Bill, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure hearing about your work and the projects ahead. I wish you success for that, and look forward to your book and also exhibition.
Thank you, Brandon. Much appreciated.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.